Welcome to Bits About Books, the home for conversations with authors of breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. Founders, entrepreneurs, and individual professionals, we all need to keep track of ideas that are helping create our today and tomorrow. Bits About Books will strive to find those books and speak to their authors, go behind the scenes and understand what inspired the authors to write the books that they did and how they went about doing so. Through our conversations, we hope to gain insights that will help us to get the most out of our efforts. I'm your host Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform where our mission is to make buying easy. Thank you for your time and for joining us in this session. I have a favor to ask. While you continue to listen to the podcast, please leave a comment or rating at iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts from. It means a lot to hear from you. On to today's episode, we have with us Justin Roff Marsh, and we will speak with him about his legendary book, The Machine.
Salespeople really should be members of a coordinated team rather than autonomous agents. You know, the core problem that we were grappling with that was preventing us from attaining the levels of productivity that we were looking for was this fact that salespeople were autonomous. They were marching to their own drumbeat. So all of the assumptions that underpin the design of the modern sales function make absolute sense in the context of the 1950s, but no sense at all in the modern context, no sense at all. And some people do see it, and some people are amassing huge fortunes as a result of seeing it, but they tend to exist outside of the sales ecosystem. So an example of somebody who clearly sees it is Jeff Bezos. I mean, he understands that when you're selling commodity products, simple transactions, the ideal customer interface is no interface at all. So his whole objective at Amazon is to make it as easy as possible for somebody to make a purchase, which means making his platform to some extent almost invisible. It's as close to a friction-free interface as you can possibly get.
For 20 years, Justin Roff Marsh's deep thinking and writing on the subject of sales process engineering has blazed a trail for others to follow. Justin is the author of The Machine, a radical approach to the design of the sales function. He is the founder of Ballistics, a consultancy with operations in North America, the Europe, and Australasia. He sold insurance and then co-founded a firm that sold financial education and quickly discovered that his product lacked the margins required to sustain a typical field-based sales force. He developed his approach to sales process engineering in response to this challenge. He argues passionately that the application of scientific management principles to the sales process is the next great uncharted frontier for the industry. His message is always controversial, but it never fails to delight audiences. The book is the winner of gold in the sales category of the Axiom Business Book Awards. Now, onto this exciting episode with Justin Roff Marsh. Justin, welcome to Bits About Books. I'm so excited to have you here to talk about The Machine. I read this book many years back, and it struck me as a hugely contrarian view, and a lot of what you spoke is actually becoming more mainstream today. So I would like to start with hearing how you actually thought about this.
Well, good morning. It's nice to be here. My intention wasn't initially to write a book. My intention was to fix a sales function for a business that I was working for. I arrived at the central idea in the book, which is that salespeople really should be members of a coordinated team rather than autonomous agents, as a byproduct of the pursuit of better sales productivity in that organization that I was working before. And I tried everything else and eventually ended up recognizing in exasperation that, you know, the core problem that we were grappling with that was preventing us from attaining the levels of productivity that we were looking for was this fact that salespeople were autonomous. They were marching to their own drumbeat. And the reason why that was a problem is that we didn't have perfect alignment between management, what we wanted, and between salespeople. And I recognized eventually that it was just impossible, certainly impractical, to play with the comp plan in an effort to create perfect alignment, which is kind of the default assumption in the sales world, that if you have an alignment problem, the solution is to play with the comp plan. But you can only pursue that direction fruitlessly for so long before you have to recognize, well, this fundamentally doesn't work.
It's an interesting thing. I was reading up some data, and it sort of appeared, and I don't know whether you agree with this whole new or modern sales structure that we talk of was actually, to a great extent, invented by Jay Patterson, the founder of NCR, right, in the 1880s, where he came up with this idea of commission and quota.
Yeah.
Which sort of have stuck through even today. That's what most sales, you mentioned the comp plan, so I'm just sort of connecting it with that.
Yes.
That most of what we do today, 120, 140 years later, is still pretty much the same.
Yeah, so all of the assumptions that underpin the design of the modern sales function make absolute sense in the context of the 1950s.
Correct.
But no sense at all in the modern context. No sense at all. And the result is that the orthodoxy, if we can call it the orthodoxy, has all sorts of cracks and fissures all over it. And rather than recognizing, well, the central assumptions that underpin the orthodoxy are fundamentally flawed, which is why we have all these cracks appearing. You know, you've got a whole industry of folks running around papering over the cracks, or promising at least to paper over the cracks using, you know, different tools, whether it's training or whether it's comp plan or whether it's software. And I think that the money invested in applying Band-Aid solutions to fundamental problems has resulted in the creation of and the sustenance of some pretty large industries that find the whole idea of recognizing that the orthodoxy is fundamentally flawed, that the standard model is just so broken it's not even worth attempting to retain, you know, that's difficult for a lot of folks to recognize for fairly obvious commercial reasons.
Why is it that people are still not seeing the fact that this entire value transaction process, which is sales, right? Sales is independently nothing unless a buying happens, correct? A sales cannot happen unless a buying process happens
somewhere.
Yeah,
I mean, it's not dissimilar to new product development. You can have Edison in his lab experimenting with different types of filament, but the process amounts to nothing until something commercial comes out the other end.
Correct. So why is it that people are not recognizing or refusing to see that the fundamental process has changed?
Well, some people do see it, and some people are amassing huge fortunes as a result of seeing it, but they tend to exist outside of the sales ecosystem. So an example of somebody who clearly sees it is Jeff Bezos.
Right.
I mean, he understands that when you're selling commodity products, simple transactions, the ideal customer interface is no interface at all. So his whole objective at Amazon, and I think we could point to others who recognize this too, Michael Dell perhaps in computers, his whole objective at Amazon is to make it as easy as possible for somebody to make a purchase, which means making his platform to some extent almost invisible. It's as close to a friction-free interface as you can possibly get.
It's a very interesting thing that you mentioned Bezos, because in a lot of my other discussions, I use this example that this whole process of identifying a prospect in a sea of humanity and then trying to convince him is a very inefficient process.
Yes, yes. I mean, if we forget about sales for a moment and think about business, if you want to be rich in business, you're not going to get rich because of your sales talents, and not truly rich. If you're going to get rich in business, it's because you design a materially better product or service, or it's because you design a materially better distribution mechanism for that product or service, which really amount to the same thing. So the fountainhead of wealth, if you like it, is not sales at all, it's innovation. And the only reason why we need sales is to compensate for short-term and relatively trivial inefficiencies in an otherwise efficient marketplace. I mean, Ferrari do not need salespeople knocking on the doors of car aficionados, asking them, have they seen the latest model?
Exactly right. Exactly right. Which is to connect to the Jeff Bezos idea, Amazon doesn't care or doesn't know why you have gone to Amazon today. Right? So his job is to create a front which will make any purchase that you want to make friction-free. The buyer knows what he's looking for, correct?
And when we're talking about commodities, you know, friction-free is a big part of the value add. Because where commodity purchases are concerned, from a buyer's perspective, we just want them to be there, like electricity. We want to be able to go over to the wall and turn the light on. We want it to come on. We don't want to be troubled with, well, you know, what are the terms of the agreement with the utility? And and we don't want to have a personal relationship with a rep who sells it to us. So I guess this conversation's a little bit abstract. I'm not sure if your listeners would want us to get a little bit more concrete and talk about...
Absolutely. So I'll get back to the book and tell me how, as you were solving the problem in the company that you were, how did the book sort of form in your head? I mean, how did you think that whatever you were doing there can actually become the machine?
Well, let me tell you in two steps. The first step, I'll tell you how I came to the central recognition that salespeople should not be autonomous agents, and then maybe I'll tell you how we came to write the book. So I was a CEO of a company called Hudson Institute, which was selling. It's a financial planning firm today, quite successful one in Australia. Back then, we were selling membership programs. So this is back before the idea of membership became popular. We had created like a membership program, and we charged people $1,200 a year to be members of this program that gave them access to a range of services and ultimately to financial products today. Well, that's how the business is today anyway. And myself and the principal owner, the major owner of this organization, had come from the insurance industry, and we were used to building sales teams who earned huge commissions, and we were used to consequently this idea that we would just basically churn through salespeople. So in the previous company, we had a full-time trainer, and we would recruit and train 20 new salespeople every month, and they would go through a training course, and we'd release them into the wild, and most of them would fail, but we'd end up with one or two or three that did really well, and the process would repeat month after month, and we maintained a team of 100 salespeople and posted some fairly impressive sales numbers for a long period of time. But what we discovered with this new business, we didn't have anywhere near the margins, not even close to the margins, so we just couldn't afford to operate that machine. So what we realized is we couldn't employ 20 people and watch 3 of them succeed and 17 of them fail and call that a success. We just couldn't support that kind of activity. So we were desperately looking for ways to make the salespeople more efficient. And the obvious way to do that is to provide them with better and better qualified sales opportunities. So more opportunities and better qualified sales opportunities to make their job of selling easier. And we've been experimenting with all sorts of means of doing that, you know, generating leads with direct mail campaigns. I remember writing a 15-page letter, copying what some of the traditional American direct marketers used to do. And we got some success for that, but we would send this long letter explaining membership in intricate detail. And, you know, that worked in that a small, very vanishingly small percentage of people would read that and would basically provide their credit card details and purchase. But we couldn't scale because there's only 20 million or 30 million people who live in Australia. And we had to mail such a large number of folks to generate the sales. So that we tried all sorts of ideas. That was one of them. But the breakthrough occurred for us when we started running events. So in the space of about a year and a half, 2 years, we went from having, 15 people in a room in our own office to having 100 people in the room in the local tennis center to having sort of 300 people in a ballroom to having 600 people. And if you look at Hudson today, that they'll do an annual round of events and they'll have 1,200 plus people in each city. So events was the breakthrough thing, and suddenly we found ourselves in a situation where we were hosing salespeople with sales opportunities. At one point, we ran a yield on the database and we discovered that there were 15,000 people who had attended events recently and who had ticked a box on a feedback form saying they wanted to talk to salespeople and who had not received a call from a salesperson. So we suddenly went from having a shortage of sales opportunities to having a massive abundance. And the interesting thing was that we observed that through all this, salespeople's sales volumes and consequently their commissions had increased incrementally, but only incrementally. And what we recognized is that that these people just didn't want to earn huge incomes. They had settled into a lifestyle that they were comfortable with. And the small number of folks who did want to earn huge incomes were the folks who we didn't want talking to customers. They were kind of the weirdos and the psychopaths. And, we really didn't want to expose our customers to them. And when we did expose our customers to them, we had all sorts of nasty knock-on consequences. So about that point, we recognized we had a choice. We're spending all this money on this event machine, but we weren't harvesting the sales. So either we reduce the expenditure or we take away salespeople's autonomy. So that's exactly what we did. We said, look, we're going to have four or five offices. We're going to have a salesperson sitting in each of those offices. We're going to have a receptionist out front, and we're going to maintain a queue of prospects sitting in the office waiting to talk to the salesperson, a lot like a doctor's office. And we'll have the receptionist make them coffee, feed them in one at a time, and we'll have a call center that maintains the queue of prospects waiting to talk to a salesperson. And that way a salesperson can have, 12 selling conversations in a day. And that changed everything, because all of a sudden we could chew through these sales opportunities probably one and a half orders of magnitude faster than we were previously. And we only needed five salespeople instead of 20 salespeople. So it had a profound transformational impact. And we also discovered that, we could have a salesperson doing 12 presentations a day and maybe making four sales, and we could pay them a normal salary. We didn't have to pay them the outrageous commissions they would have earned in the old model if they were producing that same volume of output. So we could take someone whose market value was, $80,000, which was a lot of money back then, and we could pay them $90,000 and they'd be absolutely thrilled. And we could have them produce the amount of value that we would have happily paid someone $250,000 to produce in the old model, but we never could quite get anybody to operate at that level of productivity. So that was the breakthrough. And it didn't take long to realize that the one fundamental thing that we changed was we took away salespeople's autonomy. We said, you're no longer, an independent gunslinger. You are now an employee. You sit in the room, you talk intelligently to people, you convince them to purchase. And then when the receptionist comes to grab them, you say to the receptionist, hey, Johnny and Mary are joining us. Make sure you take down their credit card details on the way out.
Hmm.
And that was the first time I think I had built a sales function that qualified to be called a machine.
It's time for a short break. And when we come back, we will hear Justin talk about what he thinks should be the only job for the salesperson. The answer is so obvious that you'd think why we do not do that. Don't go anywhere. We will be right back. You are listening to a Business Podcast Network original. Podcasting is the fastest growing content marketing opportunity, which is untapped. We can help you craft your audio strategy and help leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that the smartphone penetration provides. It is easy, it is powerful and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to your targets like never before. Write to us at bpn@bizcast.in. That is bpn@bizcast.in. Business Podcast Network. Podcasts end to end. Welcome back. As we went into the break, Justin started to explain what he thinks should be the only job of a salesperson. Let's find out.
Yeah, so if you look at the essential characteristics of that model that I just described, it's exactly the same as the essential characteristics of what I advocate in the book and of every single sales function we build for clients today. Now, even though I don't think we've ever built another sales function for clients where we had salespeople sitting in offices that look like doctors' waiting rooms. But if you think about the essential characteristics, and you mentioned a few of them, the first is that salespeople are salaried team members. They're paid their market value, perhaps a little bit more. They don't have to prospect. Opportunities are provided for them. Selling is mandatory, not optional. If somebody comes to work and decides not to sell, then they only get away with that for about 3 days in a row, and then they don't come to work anymore. And the other is that they have no transactional responsibilities whatsoever. So the only thing they do is have selling conversations. You know, our salespeople would not take customers' credit card details. They would walk someone to the door of their office, the receptionist would come and grab them, and the salesperson would say to the receptionist, as I said before, John and Mary are, you know, joining us as new members, and the receptionist would go and do all of the logistics. So our salespeople in that model and today did nothing other than selling conversations, one after another, after another, after another.
So tell me, from your experience, you are doing this now for the last...
27 years.
So this model was... This happened 27 years back?
This happened a bit more. This happened further back than that. So, The problem with that business, I was the CEO, but I was a minor shareholder, like a 10% shareholder. So, as we started to get some success, I realized, well, you know, I was going to end up building a really successful business here and having a tiny percentage of it. Maybe I'd be better off starting my own business. So, I spun out from that company and started Ballistics, and the idea behind Ballistics obviously was to take this central idea and build an empire, which hasn't yet eventuated, but that was the idea. I could build an empire, around this idea.
Obviously, the fact that you have sustained it for this long means wherever you are actually implementing the idea, it is successful, yet it is still not mainstream. I mean, where do you think that friction is?
It's an interesting question. I was hoping you would be able to tell. I was hoping you'd be able to tell me. So I think that there's a couple of things I can point to. Number one, I think that sales folks and marketing folks like to overblow the importance of sales in the scheme of things, and I touched on this before. Really, what drives business success is, you know, better product, better distribution, better operational performance. Not in that order, probably product, then operational performance, then distribution. And I think the sales piece is a subset of distribution, and I think if you do a really good job of the product design and the operational performance, the better the job you do of those two, the less important sales is. So I think that one of the reasons why sales is so unsophisticated in even the most sophisticated organizations is that it's really not that important in the scheme of things. And interestingly, it's the organizations that have the least differentiated products or services that sometimes have the more sophisticated sales process, you know, auto dealerships and real estate brokerages. Would probably apply significantly more effort to sales on a per dollar of revenue basis than organizations that are much more sophisticated than, say, a Samsung, for example. The other reason, I think, is that there's a huge resistance to change. You can't take a few of our ideas and implement them. If you read The Machine and fall in love with these ideas, you basically need to go back to your organization and tear the sales function apart and rebuild it brick by brick from the ground up. So this is not an idea for the faint-hearted. And the consequence of that is that folks will not make these kind of changes until they absolutely have to, because they are controversial and risky.
That's a very interesting thought, because you rather risk going out of business by having an outdated sales model than take risk on something which actually fits into the future.
That's correct, but most businesses go out of business very, very slowly. So slowly you can hardly notice it. And in fact, so slowly so that the current leadership won't even be there once it goes out of business. So I was with a business just recently that has 104 salespeople. They do about $100 million a year in sales, and they are dying. But they're not going anywhere in the next 10 years. In 10 years' time, they'll still be generating healthy profits, and they can probably find ways to, they can probably go 10 years at least. And for a 10-year period, they can probably find cost reductions and efficiency improvements, exploiting new technologies that enable them to retain reasonable margins. So to a casual observer, they still appear to be a perfectly vibrant, commercially viable business. Now, the problem with that is if you work for the business, it's not an exciting place to work, because once you get really close to the business, you realize, well, hang on, this business is actually shrinking. Our net profits might be stable, but our revenues are consistently decreasing, year after year after year after year. But, if you're a 22-year-old, upwardly mobile line manager, that would be very concerning for you. But if you're a 55-year-old salesperson, or if you're a 60-year-old middle manager, then you're probably not losing too much sleep at nights. So I think that this is one of the reasons why organizations don't have to change rapidly. Organizations like those do get shook up from time to time. For example, private equity firms will gobble up either them and force change on them, or they will gobble up their competitors, or you'll have new upstarts like Amazon who wreak havoc in the marketplace and who turn a slow, painless decline into a sudden, painful decline. But I think there are a lot of businesses we come across that are not as healthy on the inside as they appear to be on the outside. And but they're doing quite fine in the short term, and they need a reason to make the kind of radical changes that we're advocating here.
So one observation before I get back to the book again is that I think Forrester or Gartner says that already more than one third of the selling and buying positions are filled up by millennials. Which means they will be very, very concerned about where they are working.
And not necessarily because they're millennials, but because they're at the beginning of their career, not the end of their career.
That's what I meant, yeah. Coming back to the book, you have a chapter called Why CRM Sucks. Let's talk about that a bit. Why do you think CRM is not working yet? It's like a $20, $30 billion business today.
So we love CRM. In fact, we have our own technology department, and we have our own technology stack that includes a CRM. So we're not by any means cynical in a general sense when it comes to CRM, but I am a cynic when it comes to the idea that CRM is useful. or anything much more than useful for traditional salespeople. So the point of that chapter is that in the traditional sales model, where the salesperson is a commissioned, autonomous, semi-independent agent, essentially, that salesperson probably doesn't need a CRM. I mean, the CRM has some advantages, but it also has some disadvantages. If you compare a CRM with a traditional day timer, you know, a calendar system, you know, the day timer boots faster than a computer. It's easier to use when you're sitting behind the wheel of a vehicle. It's arguably more intuitive. It's quicker to get in and out of it. It has a whole bunch of benefits over a CRM. The only benefit that the CRM has over the day timer is if you lose your day timer, you've lost all your data. But if you lose your notebook computer, then your data is still sitting there in the cloud. But that's less of an issue when you consider that most salespeople are actively pursuing a relatively small number of sales opportunities simultaneously, and the data that they have accrued as a consequence of that work relevant to that relating to that small percentage of opportunities is probably not that hard to remember, and the stuff they're not remembering atrophies very, very quickly. You know, the information that you collected 3 weeks ago or 6 weeks ago probably isn't worth much, you know, in another 6 weeks' time. So my point in the book is that CRM was designed by ERP people to suit an environment that they assumed existed but had never really checked. Now, the good news for CRM is that in the environments that we build, where salespeople become team members, performing repetitively, you know, carefully designed discrete activities, you know, CRM is perfect. I mean, I think that we have designed an environment, a sales environment, that the engineers who conceptualized CRM probably wished existed at the point at which they built CRM, but it didn't. And so CRM from a traditional salesperson's perspective isn't a big step forward. It provides them with some incremental benefits and some disadvantages as well. But in the environments that we build, CRM is a huge step forward, and we couldn't build the environments that we build if it wasn't for CRM. The sorts of change, if we want to create a significant increase in the performance of the sales function, you're not going to do it with CRM, but you will need a CRM. So CRM is necessary but not sufficient. To drive significant change, we need to address the design of the function itself.
What other kind of technologies as you are looking at? I mean, I'm sure you know about the sales technology stacks, and
I do.
The number of products have grown exponentially over the last like 6-7 years. There are nearly 1,000 products in the sales technology stack alone. What kind of technologies do you see are becoming critical?
A standard CRM is important and critical. We don't need tight integration between the CRM and ERP, because in the environments that we build, salespeople don't have anything to do with transactions, and they don't even need to do pre-call research because of the fact that in the environments we build, salespeople are campaign-based. So if you're a salesperson working for a client of ours, you might be, you know, for the next 10 days working on a campaign where you're approaching organizations that buy, you know, item A and item B, but who don't buy item C. And the basis of your conversation is going to be, hey, we noticed you buy A and B, but not C. Here's a special incentive for you to buy C. Now, if you're in the midst of that campaign, you don't have to do any pre-call research. It's already been done for you in the design of the campaign and the compilation of the list. You know that every person you're talking to is in exactly the same criteria, so you can jump straight into the call. So from your perspective, all you really need is a CRM. The CRM doesn't have to be tightly coupled with ERP. If you win a transaction, you're directly handing it off to customer service to manage that order, and they're doing it in ERP. So you definitely need a CRM. The CRM only needs to be loosely coupled with ERP. The only thing that we would synchronize is the address book, basically nothing else. Marketing department would definitely benefit from having marketing automation software. That's a very exciting category. Aside from that, we don't use much else. I'm not that interested in anything that automates opportunity management, because if we move sales inside, which we do in 99% of cases, a salesperson can comfortably have 20 selling conversations a day, sitting on a queue of 80 opportunities, and that rate of work, I think, is a comfortable rate of work. We're not that interested in increasing the efficiency of the salesperson over and above that, because I think, you know, you hit diminishing returns if you try and get somebody to operate at an unnatural rate of work. So, you know, I think 20 selling conversations a day for an inside salesperson is a maximum sustainable rate of work. Most of our clients sell things that are expensive or complex, so we're really not that interested in auto dialers or artificial intelligence or any of these other cool, or gamification, or any of these other cool sounding ideas, because we're not, you know, 20 selling conversations a day, 5 days a week, you know, multiplied by five or six salespeople is a shit ton of sales activity. And, you know, typically our clients will increase by 4 or 5 times their volume of sales activity without any increase in headcount. And generally speaking, that's that's enough. You will spend, if you do that all of a sudden, you're going to spend the next 5 years trying to scale up your operations to keep up with that volume of sales activity. The only other technologies that we like, we're big fans of salespeople using video conferences and doing formal presentations to customers. So we do like video conferencing software, and we do like particularly video conferencing type software that allows them to drive a slide presentation, like slide shared type technology we like. Mm-hmm. And there might be some other bits and pieces as well, but you know, we're surprisingly low tech when it comes to when you consider the sorts of efficiency that we're exploiting, that we're generating in sales teams. The other thing is, in our stack, we have an application called Insightful, which basically enables status boards in every team environment. And that's something I'm very proud of, and that has a big impact on the productivity of teams. So the idea there is that we want every team to have a big screen on the wall that gives them that visualizes data in such a way that they have a real-time feedback loop, so that they can see the connection between the effort that's being expended on a hour-to-hour basis and the results that are being generated. So we do that in customer service and sales environments, and we're thinking about engineering environments now.
So this tool is something you have, your team has developed, or is it a standalone tool available for others?
No, so Insightful is an application that we've developed, but to be honest, you could achieve a similar result with Domo or with Power BI or with any other business intelligence tools. The advantage for us of building our own is that we can build widgets, you know, charting objects that are custom designed to suit the requirements of the environments that we design. But really, there's nothing particularly special there that you couldn't do in any BI application.
Right. What would you say should be the motivating reason why people should seriously look at the model that you are advocating?
Well, I think that if it's necessary for you to improve sales performance in order to grow your organization, and if your current model is exhibiting signs of diminishing returns, then you should read the book. So in other words, if you're at the point where you can't generate enough sales to run 3 shifts in manufacturing or to ship your software at the rate necessary to hit plan or whatever the, you know, the requirement is, but then you're in a situation where you can't just scale up your existing sales function. So if you have 10 salespeople and you're reluctant to add another 10 because you think that adding another 10 salespeople isn't going to result in a commensurate increase in revenue, then you've hit diminishing returns. So the first thing I would recommend is recognize that you've hit diminishing returns. Recognize that this is a serious problem, not a trivial problem. And read the book.
Great. And before I let you go, the question is there a follow-up book in the making?
I've spent 20 years trying to figure out how to monetize and build a business around that one central realization. I think it probably makes more sense for me to stick to my knitting and continue to do that. There is a part of me that likes the idea of writing other books. I wouldn't mind writing a book on measurements. I think that organizations overcomplicate measurements. I think that there's huge value in having a single number for each function within the organization. I think sometimes about writing a book about how to build a system of measurements that simplifies management down to the point where each department is accountable to a single number. But to be honest, I think if I wrote a book like that, it would be for my own intellectual titillation. I don't think there's a good commercial reason to diversify at this point. I think there's still plenty of life in the ideas in the book.
Bits About Books is brought to you by PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high-quality engagement between buyers and sellers through its presentation and discussion modules. Sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos, and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement. PitchLink requires no installation or download and holds the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without intrusion. Call us on 99021-631-32.
Coming up in the next episode with Amos Schwartzfarb is possibly one of the most important books for the global startup ecosystem, Sell More Faster, the ultimate sales playbook for startups. He knows a thing or two on sales for startups. As the managing director of Techstars in Austin with his over 70 investments in startups and the six where he drove product market fit and revenue.
We had a muddy definition of who our customer was, what they were buying from us and why it mattered. And I clicked on to those three things and said, okay, we need to define these things. And we defined them, and that took, 2, 3, 4 weeks of digging into the data, myself and my team. And we were wholly focused on really tight definitions of who our customer was, what they were buying from us, and why it mattered. And at the end of that, when we said, okay, we now know exactly those three things with data. So it was no longer what we believed, but we actually had data to support it. It was sort of like obvious to me that this was our W3 and I say that in this context, which is that I had a small team of people working on this, and we wanted to find a way to get the whole company, the whole sales organization, and the whole company aligned and behind this so we can move it forward, because we had so much conviction that we were right. And again, me taking concepts that may be complex or not and trying to make them as simple as possible, for me, it was really obvious to say, great, let's name this thing and call it something that we can describe easily and get everybody behind. So we named it W3, who, what, and why. We described it to the company. Who is our customer? Here's the definition. What are they buying from us? Here's what they're buying from us, and why does it matter to them? Here's what it is. And that simple framework, the whole company was able to understand and believe and get behind. And in that process, we took the company from $7 million to $60 million in a really short amount of time. So we saw it work.
We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of weeks with great conversations with Rand Fishkin, Brant Pindivik, and Amos Schwartzfarb. Stay tuned. Thank you for being with us today on Bits About Books, where we talk to authors about breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and buy the book to learn firsthand and implement some of the great ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of Bits About Books. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platforms like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcast from, and give us a rating while you are at it.
This BizCast original podcast is produced for PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where the mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Subhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time and have a wonderful day.